Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. We have a great show for you today. But when I'm not hosting In the Drink, I do work on a small amount of organic Italian wine made with indigenous grapes called Annona. You can find Annona wines at a bunch of great restaurants and retailers, mostly in the tri-state area, but now we're in California and Texas and Colorado as well. But check out www.annonawine.com. And I'm hearing my girlfriend Alyssa say, you don't need to say the www, but just annonawine.com. People know that it's on the worldwide webs, and look for that. I also want to start the show by wishing a congratulations to my friends David Page and Barbara Shin, who recently sold their wineries. A little local news. They sold the Shin Winery, and they are, I think, just enjoying sort of an early retirement. That they've done a lot for sustainability on the North Fork of Long Island, and had just had some really nice experiences at their bed and breakfast and drinking the wines. So that was really great. But I am excited for today's show. This is going to be a fantastic show. And, you know, we hear so much about the superstar winemakers that get so much adoration, and the now superstar sommeliers who, you know, are all over magazines. But, you know, without the importers and distributors, the wine would just be where it is, and the sommeliers wouldn't be able to buy any, at least not here in the U.S., where it's required that you work with an importer and a distributor. And so we have just one of the absolute best. We have in the studio today Michael Skernick, who is the founder and chief executive of Skernick Wines. They're celebrating 30 years in business. Welcome to In the Drink. It's such
Thank
a pleasure.
You. Thanks, Joe. It's great to be here. First of all, great news for David Page and Barbara Shin. Very, very pleased to hear that. I guess you could say they could go home again now, which is Home was the name of their restaurant that they had on Cornelia Street.
Oh, that's right.
About 30 years ago, before they moved to Long Island to try and start to grow grapes out there, follow the Hargraves out there. So kudos to them. Yeah, now, maybe they can come back and start the restaurant again.
That would be great. I mean, yeah. I'd love to where do you have that experience where, you know, maybe in Europe, but where you're staying in their, you know, in their home, they have the bed and breakfast, and then they're cooking the food with, you know, their own ingredients. Yeah. And it, in New York, it's hard to find.
That's
something like
pretty
that.
Great. Thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I love the setup here. I mean, Joey was explaining this setup for the recording studio is actually in an old container, restored container in the back of Roberta's restaurant pizzeria.
That's right. This is a shipping container.
So
that's the world you live in.
Exactly. I've never actually sat inside a container before.
Your first 30 years in the biz.
30 years, and we probably ship
How many containers a year?
I'm afraid to say it's a lot.
A lot of containers.
It's a lot of containers.
People will think
it's a four-letter word. A lot.
That you're a larger company than you are if you say how many containers. Is that your concern?
I guess I'm not really concerned, but let people think what they want.
Okay.
But, what's the old adage? Sizes and everything? I don't know.
That's a good point. You hear that a lot. You hear that a lot.
But I guess, what is Skernick Wines today? After 30 years, we were celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, which is cool.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'd love to know what are the biggest, most striking differences between the industry when you started? Mm-hmm. Obviously, your company has grown so much, and I do want to get into that as well. But what was the industry like in the 80s, and what's it like now?
Well, it's changed a lot. I guess, without tooting my own horn, I'm tooting the horns of all those who alongside me have really toiled and worked hard to bring finer foods, finer wines, finer oils, finer spices, finer coffee, fresher fish, and
they all help each other out.
Well, we've all sort of done this side by side, and I think in 30 years, I would say, one thing for sure is that there's no place in the world where there's better eating options, dining options, wine consuming options, spirit cocktail options than the United States in general and New York in particular. And that's a result of the last 30 years of day after day after day of working hard and knocking down doors and getting people to pay attention to and take care of themselves in what they consume in a better way. So after all those years, like when I first started, if you went out, I worked at Windows on the World, which is the restaurant at the top of the Twin Towers. And I was a waiter. I started as a lunch waiter, became a dinner waiter, and then I became a sommelier, worked for Kevin Zrelli. If you went out in Manhattan in those days, in 1977, 76, 77, 78, you went to pretty much any restaurant and you wanted to have a glass of wine, you had two options. You had white and red. It was house white and house red. There was no such thing
as... There was no wine left.
There was no varietal wine available by the glass. You had white and red. That's it. You wanted to drink a different kind of wine, then you had to buy a bottle off the list. And that list would probably be predominantly French. Well, the only great thing about it is that the price of the wines on the list probably would have been, $20 and less.
Yeah.
You could buy...
It was possible to drink the benchmark
wines. A Premier Cru Chassagne from, Michel Nyon for $20.
Right.
Because the supply and demand factor. Very few people knew about the great wines. I mean, the great wines of Burgundy being, sort of discovered by Frank Schoonmaker and people like that, who encouraged the producers to start estate bottling the wine. The best French wines were available in New York, which is still true.
Only now, if you try to order the best French wine, maybe you can't pay your rent that month.
You can't. Right. Exactly. and so it's sort of like imagine an invisible spider web. If it was flat parallel to the ground and you picked it up and the silk would stretch, the top of that, now you're creating a spiderweb pyramid. At the top is, Napa Valley Cabernet and, Biondi Santi Brunello and Angelo Gaia's, Barbareschi, et cetera. When you lift that web up, you create space underneath, right? If you think of it like a isosceles triangle on the bottom, that's why we have all this fantastic array of great options we have now, wines from the Jura and, Falanghina and Côte de Volpe from Campania and,
now you're speaking my language.
Norella Mascalese and all of these great options that are much more affordable. At the same time, winemaking in general, the quality of winemaking has improved radically over 30 years. We're still kind of going with your question about what's changed in 30 years. So that's another thing is on the winemaking side and the
quality,
especially
is really
the vineyard grape growing side, the viticultural side of things. The improvements have been, stratospheric. And so at the same time that the pricing of benchmark wines went in the stratosphere. So did, you know, all of the improvements in viticulture and vinification and the marketing, the market being thirsty for things that people could afford.
So, I think I hear a lot that it's never been a better time to drink wine. Do you agree with that? Even considering these benchmarks are, you know, it's so rare and hard to find and so expensive now, whereas you used to be able to buy them. Is this the best time to drink wine?
It depends what kind of wine you like to drink. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want, it's the best time to drink wine if you want to be able to go almost anywhere in New York and drink a good bottle of wine, absolutely, hands down, for sure. But if you wanted to drink, great aged Burgundy, no, you have to go to La Pole. I mean, that's it, pretty much.
That's where.
Or hang out with five people who are, you know, actually it's four now because one's in jail, but four great collectors of wine who have probably, you know, 65% of all the rare wine in the world, in their own cellars.
And 50% of that is real.
Who knows? Nobody really knows.
Okay, so you're at
the problem is also not that many people care. Not enough people care.
You want to believe it. If it's in front of you, you're like, oh, this is a once in life. You don't want to think it's...
You know, a lot of people drink labels, so they don't really look further than that. So,
okay, so you're at Windows on the World. What was that like? Was Kevin a sommelier? Was he the only sommelier in New York at the time? What was that like?
Well, he wasn't the only, but he was the youngest. He was 20. He started, he was 25 years old. And I think through the wisdom of Joe Baum, who is a legend, a restaurant, New York restaurateur legend, and Barbara Kafka, who also is a legend, who worked for the company. It was Barbara Kafka, actually, as I recall, whose idea it was to hire a young 25-year-old kid like Kevin, mm-hmm. who was actually a wine salesperson. His wine selling career was the shortest in the history of New York. I think it was 3 or 4 months. He worked for Charmer, which was the predecessor of Empire, one of the predecessors. And Windows on the World was a new account. It wasn't open yet, and he called on the account, and he impressed Barbara Kafka so much that she decided or suggested to Joe Baum to hire this kid. Prior to that, you had, you know, tuxedo-clad, test van, silver chain-wearing sommeliers in New York at the 21 Club, places like that. But they were all, you know, gray hairs and, 60 years and older, because much the same way that people used to think that unless you were, you know, a long gray beard and were old, you couldn't possibly have the wisdom to know, to be able to communicate, you know, what it is about sensitive or, you know, interesting subjects like that. So how could a young person know enough about wine to recommend wine to the clientele? And the average clientele was probably twice Kevin's age. So that was the first thing. And they put together a great wine list. Kevin, there was a gentleman named Alexis Lachine. I don't know if you know that name.
But, I don't.
You know, Alexis Lachine, amongst the many things he did, was an importer, but he wrote, it's called the Alexis Lachine Encyclopedia of Wine. It was one of the early encyclopedic books on wine. But he was from Bordeaux, and he had tremendous connections in Bordeaux, and all of the old Bordeaux was sourced for Windows on the World through Alexis Lachine. If you look through, I don't know if you can find it in history, or you'll see some very old bottles that'll say Alexis Lachine and Company. Mm-hmm. That name brand was eventually sold to Southern Wine and Spirits, so it doesn't mean the same anymore. I think his son is the gentleman named Sasha Lachine, who was behind the Whispering Angel Rosé, which is now ubiquitous everywhere. So it's a family that's been in the business for a long time. And all the old Bordeaux, the wines that I was weaned on, what I tasted when I was, you know, just a young kid working at Windows, were all of these great wines. The Bordeaux's went back to 1900, you know, Calon Segur, Montrose, Bechevel, Lange Bage, you know.
Jeez.
34, Mouton, 45, you know, Latour, 45, 47, 49, 52, 53, 55, you know, 59, 61, all the great vintages, tasted them over and over and over again, as well as Burgundy.
You had the opportunity to taste
I had
them.
Many opportunities to taste because...
So this what inspired your interest in wine?
Yeah.
Your first...
Well, it started earlier than that because my parents were into wine, which is very unusual growing up in Merrick, Long Island, where I did.
I can imagine,
Well, my mother was like... just she was a very smart lady, and she just was very interested in a lot of things, very mm-hmm. cultural. And they went to France in 1970, discovered wine, came back, bought a walk-in refrigerator, put it in the basement of our house, and bought...
Just for wine?
Yeah, just for wine.
Wow.
And she filled that walk-in with 61, 66 Bordeaux's, and some Burgundies as well, and also some German Riesling. Those are the three categories that we had. That was it. A little Rioja as well.
It's amazing.
So I was exposed to wine in a small way that I knew. I was aware. I knew what Beaujolais was. I knew that these were places and where wine was made, and I knew that wine was supposed to. That food was supposed to be accompanied by wine.
Right. And then you really dove deeper once you went to Windows
on. When I graduated college, I wanted to live in Manhattan. I actually moved to an apartment in Tribeca before anybody knew what to call the region, and looked up at the Twin Towers and said, maybe I should go in there and apply for a job because I play guitar. I want to be a musician. Met some people who said, how do you make a living and play music in New York? Well, you've got to work in restaurants. I had no experience, so I went up there and make a long story short, I got hired. And that's how it started. But while I was there as a waiter, I started to learn about wine. And then when a job came up in the cellar, there were two assistant positions to Kevin. Excuse me. And I took it. And it was a big pay cut, but it was an opportunity to learn about wine, People always ask, what was the epiphany? What was the wine that made you a wine lover? So, and I know exactly what they were, and I can see exactly where I was when I tasted
them. Was it? And then you want to also ask yourself the next question that I have for you. No, I'm just kidding. What was the wine?
Well, there were two of them. One was the 61 Chateau Lynch-Bage. And the other was the 72 Latache. These were made me speechless.
Have you had them multiple times later on in your career? Have they kind of held up to the same esteem as
I have those? Not. I mean, I had them multiple times back in back that then? In that two and a half year period that I was there. I probably had those wines, each of those wines, about 18 different times, I would say.
Holy cow. Mm.
There was a lot of wine, and there weren't a lot of people buying, across the country. Jeez. Again, that's what I was saying.
Yeah. Okay, so then you left Windows on the World to work. You started a long tradition of people leaving the restaurant industry to work for a distributor.
Yeah, I'd like to call an end to that right now, please. Because number one, I'm losing a lot of great customers that way. And two, I'm getting a lot of great competitors that way. And mm-hmm. enough is enough, guys, all right?
I remember when I was worked for Vinifera for a year. For Vinifera Imports, uh-huh. selling wines, 22 years old, and told the founder of Vinifera that I was leaving to work at Babbo as a sommelier. And he said, "Are you crazy? No one, you've made it. You're working for a distributor. Yeah. Everyone leaves working the restaurants to do this. You're out of your mind."
Yeah, but you were only 12. So
I was 12 years old. Yeah, it was grape juice for me.
You had to go get your experience. Yeah. So things have changed a lot, and mostly. Almost entirely in a positive way. I think, today you have a fragmentation going on the same way we have in with the internet and in such easy accessibility to information. Misinformation, disinformation mm-hmm. is very prevalent in the world,
in our political world,
in our Vinus world, and in our own lives. I mean, I think it's really an interesting time. I'm hopeful that we'll look back on this time in history. I don't know how long it's going to last. 5 years, maybe 10, maybe longer, of nobody knowing truly what is going on, because you don't know who's telling the truth and who's not. So I think we'll look back on this period as this sort of, amorphous time of entropy with, molecules flying around and people saying things and making statements and people believing people as Pied Pipers, that they following the wrong people mm-hmm. or the wrong ideas. And eventually it'll all sort out like a sorting table, and eventually things will settle down, and you'll know that, if you listen to Joey Campanelli's show, you're going to get the straight dope and, no bull from him, whereas somebody else is talking out their ass, So I think there's a lot of that going on right now, and people, especially young people, who don't have the didn't have the benefit or the good fortune that I did, mm-hmm. people in my generation, to actually begin their wine journey and wine knowledge with the classics, and understand fully what the classics are and what the history and the tradition is. And that is the foundation upon which everything else is built.
Do you
built.
Think that's still important if someone's starting out, say, learn Bordeaux, learn what Sancerre is, learn...
Absolutely. I mean,
learn Barolo, learn the classics
first. That is a must. Mm-hmm. That is a must. How can you talk about wine? How can you talk about Chardonnay if all you've had is wines from the Jura? I mean, they're very, very good wines, and they're very interesting, and sometimes they are great, no question. Especially mm-hmm. if you're going to have a wine that's 3 years old from the Jura, if you're fortunate, is going to be so amazingly open and mature, more than a 15-year-old, you know, Merceau, or maybe it'll, you know, approximate what a great age of Merceau would taste like if you pulled out a bottle of Rouleau from the cellar or something like that.
Right.
So there's great opportunity and value in that, but you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good analogy. I mean, how do you become a surgeon if you don't study medicine?
Yeah.
You can't start by specializing in, you know, being a foot surgeon. You gotta know the body.
Yeah, know what blood is.
You have to, yeah,
to know your biology.
You got
to
be
first.
Ready for yeah. for you know anything, and so I think that's missing somewhat in the desire for people to become experts mm-hmm. or to at least feel that they can be considered in the conversation.
I understand why it's tempting though, because part of the joy of wine for so many people and is this discovery aspect, finding something new, tasting something yeah. new. So I can imagine that like gravitating towards sort of more obscure things is probably really alluring.
It's true, but guess what? You know what's obscure right now? Bordeaux.
That's true. Yeah.
Obscure. You know what? There's a lack of understanding, fundamental understanding of Bordeaux.
Except for the top most famous, right, which represents a 100th of 1% of all Bordeaux.
Right, but they, you know, Bordeaux has shot themselves in the foot by you know, having the prices of all the top classified growths, the top five growths, most of them are priced too high to be on wine lists. You know mm-hmm. that, and you know, you've been in the restaurant business.
I wonder if there's going to be a correction. Like Chateau Yquem, there's like a price correction, right? They they kept jacking up the price, and then they realized, wow, this is actually affecting our sales. And
it's also, they, you know, you see this also in Napa Valley. It's the same problem with the top wines. They're too expensive for people to drink. Even if the style of the wines is something desirable for someone, they cannot be drunk. They cannot be ordered off of wine lists. And I think with Chateau Yquem as the world's greatest sweet wine, the world's the absolute top, you know, Sauternes, there's such a small market for that wine now because the trend is not to drink sweet wine mm-hmm. pretty much. So they're feeling it. There's, you know, it's just, but you know, in there, there's opportunity to rediscover, because I mean, one of the greatest experiences you can have is a aged, mature Chateau Yquem. And what I like to do is find a friend who's richer than me.
And I
find somebody who's got some Chateau Yquem and hang out with them. That's what I would do.
That's the move.
Yeah.
I
happen to have one. I have a friend who has a great collection of Chateau Yquem. You know who you are. And we get together for dinner. There's a bunch of us get together for dinner 3-4 times a year, and we always finish with the Yquem. That's the only time I ever drink it.
Yeah.
And I cannot drink more than an ounce and a half of it.
Right. You have a half bottle. That's good for like 6 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At least.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back more with Michael Skernick, the founder of Skernick Wines, right after this.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, "Eat them to save them," was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
We're back on In the Drink. I'm here with Michael Skernick, the founder of Skernick Wines, celebrating their 30 years in business. And they just a ton of great wines and spirits. And I was actually going back through some of our archives, and I realized that we have quite a few of our guests have been wines that are represented by Michael Skernick. I just want to go through them with you. Most recently, we had Kathy Corzine, who is who's been there since the beginning, who's been with you for 30 years, a true legend. Mm-hmm. Paris Segalas of Domaine Segalas, Oscar Binky of Herman J. Weimer, Jasmine Hirsch, Hirsch Winery, Ivan Giuliani of Taranzuolo, Victor
Arutia
of Cune, Cara Boskis of Ipira. That was actually my first Barolo visit ever. Mark Fornatale set that up for me. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mark. Raj Parr has been on several times of Sandi. Matt Licklider of Lioko. We actually have also had your spirits portfolio manager. I don't know if that's his correct title, but Adam Schumann, who's putting together the most interesting, you know, liquor program in the city right now. Yeah. And I was also going through, I mean, you have hundreds of different producers, and there are so many I would love to have on the show. Some that I would like to. Can you help with this? Terry Thies, can you get him on the show?
Well, I can probably put it this way. I can probably help more than most people.
All right.
But that's not saying a lot.
Yeah.
Because Terry is a very busy man.
He's very
busy.
Just
ask him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't live in New York, and he doesn't come through New York that often. But
Terry, please, next time you're in New York, if you're listening, we would love to have you on the show.
This is a plea. Please. Terry Thies, if you're out there, please come visit the show.
And for you, those of you who don't know, Terry Thies works with Michael and imports some of the best grower champagne. I mean, really, put grower Thank champagne you. On the you know on everyone's radar. Right. And kudos to you for going big when he said that we should have. I mean, from my understanding of the story, Terry was like, we should have grower champagne, and I wanted to bring in a lot of them. And you guys said, okay, let's bring in like a bunch of them. Let's go big on this and not just like put your toe in the water.
We were used to engaging in labors of love, which mm-hmm. is what I like to call them. You know, we've done this so many times over that it's not, it doesn't dissuade us when we discover something that's really new and interesting, whether there's a market or not for it. It started with with German Riesling. You know, we didn't invent the market for German Riesling, but it was pretty much close to non-existent when we started with Terry selling German wines in the United States. And getting the beginning was finding, you know, kindred souls in people like Paul Greco, for sure, but even before him, Steve Olson, who mm-hmm. was the guy that opened the Gramercy Tavern Wine Program with Danny Meyer, Scott Carney, who was the brains behind Gotham Bar Wine Program, a number of people like that who believed in Riesling when nobody wanted to know anything about Riesling or German Riesling. So we did that. And some years after that, Terry said, hey, I got another great idea, Austrian wine. Mm-hmm. And there had been this tremendous scandal in Austria, I think in, what year was it? I want to say
87, 89, something like that?
No. More recent. It was I think 85. I forget exactly. There was a terrible scandal. People died. Some giant industrial wineries in Austria had... without getting into it, it really ruined the entire market for Austrian wine, which was tiny.
They doctored their wines with poison, right?
Essentially,
with methanol.
It was diethylene glycol, which was which is something that is actually an antifreeze, but can mimic oiliness or glycerol qualities in the wine and sweetness. So the style was for sweet wine, and so there were some. It was terrible. So Austrian wine was completely destroyed globally, and the next generation of kids came up and they said, you know, we've got to change things here. And the revolution that took place was nothing short of extraordinary. Terry found out about it, went over and made some great contacts. Nobody was bringing in Austrian wine, and so he had basically could handpick all the best wineries. And so we brought this strange grape called Grüner Veltliner into the New York market at that time, and nobody knew what it was. And so we had to go out and find champions again, on-premise, restaurants, by the glass, wine lists, get the sommeliers of
the
day.
Who are the early Grüner Veltliner champions?
Basically the same people I mentioned for Riesling. Yeah,
that makes sense.
People who were looking for mineral wines that expressed the sense of place and went great with food, especially Grüner Veltliner. Like there's no better wine with asparagus or artichoke, the two enemies of all wine anywhere. So we started that. So then when Terry, you know, the third part of the triumvirate, the grower champagne movement, when he suggested that, we said, we're all in. We're all in. Let's do it. Once again, he went to Champagne. Nobody was bringing in grower champagnes. When I say nobody, of course there are exceptions to all those rules. Skernick Wines was an exception. We were already importing and selling happily Aigle Urier, which is one of the great grower champagnes from Ambonnet. And
still after all these years, even better
every year. Every year they get better and better and better.
I love the rosé.
Yeah, the rosé is great. The wines are on the lease. Some of the wines were on the lease for like 6 years.
And so there's a Pinot Meunier cuvée too, right?
Yes. Yes, the Vrigny, which was his wife's, a parcel that belonged to his wife. So we began with grower champagne. And we were very successful, of course, because the wines are fabulous. The wines of Villemar and Pierre Peters and some of the other producers that are in the Terry Theis portfolio. Now, it's a good time to talk about the fact that, you know, the term grower champagne has become ubiquitous, and now everybody wants to drink grower champagne. So, great. But just because it's grower champagne doesn't mean it's better champagne.
Right.
You know, there are lots of growers in Champagne. There are four or five or a handful of Grand Marks in Champagne who are basically négociants. They dominate the champagne business. Before we started importing grower champagne, it was probably 95% of all the champagne was sold by Grand Marks. I don't know what the number is now, but it's considerably less. But they're still nobody's losing any sleep or crying for the Grand Mark champagne producers. But now we've seen a lot of people decide, I'm going to bring in some grower champagne. Well, it doesn't mean it's better. That's my point. In Champagne, the overall same thing that I said earlier about
it's
Burgundy,
like the craft beer movement. Right? Not every craft beer is like
most of them are not good. Most of the craft beer are not good.
But the best experiences with beer
are going to be craft beer, and the best. Very good, thank you. The best experiences with champagne are going to be grower champagne. The best growers make the best champagne. So, again, you got to taste for yourself. And today, there are lots of great grower champagnes in the market that are not with Terry Theis and not with Skernick, and there are lots of great grower champagnes that are with us. And you know, it's fascinating because
you helped create a market for this,
right.
And I think it's better for everyone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So with so many producers at this point, and I think just extraordinarily high quality producers, how do you decide who you're going to take on? Is there a philosophy, a mission statement? Is there something that you go back to when you decide on someone new?
Specific to champagne or just in general?
In general.
No, it's taste. It's just tasting. You know, we taste all the time. We taste every day. you mentioned Mark Fornatale, so he's the Italian portfolio manager, and we've got a manager in each portfolio.
A guru.
Yeah. Really is, so, yeah. But we work together. So, you know, my brother Harm and I, we're like the hub of the wheel, and all the portfolios are like spokes that come out from this hub. We have people like Mark in each portfolio, or Adam Schumann in the spirits portfolio. They do research. We bring samples. We taste together with each portfolio manager, and we choose. And, you know, we taste, we reject, we reject 95% of everything that we taste. Not always because the wine isn't good, mostly because the wine isn't good or not good enough for our portfolio. But often it's also because, you know, we may have 27 Dolcettos already.
Right, and that's enough.
Yeah. It depends.
I mean, one of the things that your company is known for is attracting great people to work for you. I mean, you have, you know, just had Mark Fornatale, you have Schwartz is amazing, right. Adam Schumann. You have all of these incredible people who are working for you, and also Joel Schott. Mm-hmm. You have great people and Joel.
That sounds like a t-shirt. And also .. and also Joel Schott.
How do you go about attracting such incredible talent?
Well, first
talent?
We have these microchips that we put in, you know, we implant in their necks, and so they can't get away. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
And if they act poorly, you zap them?
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's a desire after, you know, 30 years of building the business, whatever it is that we are, and whatever it is that the perception is that we are, is attractive to people who are curious and have a thirst for knowledge, want to learn, and want to also be want to be in an environment where they can learn constantly, and one where I think Harmon and I are big proponents of empowerment of our staff. You know, we don't, you know, we like, and whoever has the best idea wins in our environment. You know, it's not like there's a, you know, politically correct corporate, you know, structure. None of that exists. It's just, hey, you know, and it's, you know, when we moved our offices to the Flatiron in Manhattan, it was a game changer for us.
Yeah. I remember the days when people would say that they had to do their 6 months of hard time at your Long Island office, right? That was the thing. Like, they had to work at the Long Island office for 6 months before they were allowed to.
Right.
And so now, your new offices in Midtown are beautiful. Yeah. The bar that you have there, the open office setup. It's just an open setup for
you know, makes it easier for people to come and visit us and to taste with us and to, you know.
Do you ever feel like for new employees, that they're getting off too easy at this point? You're like the guys who've been here for a long time. they had to go out to Long Island. So don't you complain?
It's not so much that. It's more like it's a difficulty for us in a sense. I'm sort of half joking, but you know, if you came to us and said, look, you know, I want to work for you. I love what I hear, what I see. I want to learn about wine. And I say, well, you live in Brooklyn, but you've got to come to Syosset, Long Island, on the Long Island Railroad 5 days a week, and you've got to be there by 9 a.m., you know. You'd be like, you know, if you said yes, that told me that you had what it takes. I don't have that anymore because, you know, we're missing that filter.
Right?
It's a filter. Like, if someone's willing to do that and give up, you know, spending, because you spend more hours at work than you do anywhere else.
That's true.
So if they were willing to do that, it spoke volumes about their commitment, and usually it worked out that they were a good hire. Today, you know, but the fact is that we're, Harmon and I, we're great at two things, many things, but two specifically. One is being able to find great wines and taste and select, and the other is find great employees and select them. So the combination of those two things is really, you know, what we do better than probably anybody else.
And now in 2014, when you made the move, you also changed the name of the company from Michael Skernick Wines to Skernick Wines, right, to really reflect, from what I understand, the fact that it's not just, it's your family, right? There's a lot of people in your family.
It looks like from the outside that would have been the reason, and it certainly was part of it, but it wasn't the main impetus. Was something much simpler than that. Because my brother Harmon Skernick wanted me to change the name for 25 years. And I said, well, it's not...
To Harmon's Wines?
No, just to Skernick, right? So, but, you know, I said, look, it's not broken. There's no reason to change it. So around the same time that we moved to the city, excuse me, we also, you know, designed a new website. We designed a new logo. And we were also getting... We hired Adam Schumann, and we were getting Bellum Spirits. So in the design phase of coming up with the logo, it looked like, you know, it just didn't look right. There were too many words. If we're going to call the wines Michael Skernick Wines and Spirits, because we had a debate. Are we calling it Skernick Wines? Or are we calling it Skernick Wines and Spirits? Because Spirits is part of the company now.
Right.
And we decided it has to, Wine and Spirits has to be in the name of the company. And I said, and it wasn't Harmon pressuring me. It was like, I said, well, you know, that's too many words. Either the Spirits goes or the Michael goes. And, you know, let's get rid of the Michael and call it Skernick Wine and Spirits.
Skernick Wine and Spirits.
The fact is that we have, you know, a second generation in the business is another reason why it's good to be Skernick Wine
and Spirits. And how do you balance that? How do you, I know one of your producers, Christina Turley, was telling me about when she went to work. She lived here in the city for a while, worked for Momofuku, and she went back and worked, you know, at her parents' winery. And her dad said, okay, you have to get into the office earlier than everyone else. You have to leave after everyone. And by the way, you're getting paid as much as the least, as the person who's getting paid the least in the company.
Yeah.
How do you balance integrating family into, you know, this company with a bunch of non-family people also?
That's actually, you know, Christina's example is very well stated. You know, that's essentially what we do as well. I mean, you can't, you have to earn respect in life, in all aspects. So, you know, if they're coming in and their last name is Skernick, then there's even more pressure or more of a reason to roll up your sleeves and prove that you're not afraid to do anything or to, you know, and to work as hard, if not harder than anybody else, and roll up your sleeves, pick up the cases, clean up the tasting room. That's the kind of thing people see. You can't just say, oh, you have to respect me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that doesn't work. You have to show that you deserve respect. And I think that's what we've achieved, you know, so far.
Yeah. And I just want to finish on, you mentioned that you have a new website, and I want to give a plug to you for something that I think that you're doing is really cool. The Skernick Unfiltered.
Okay.
It's hard to find good information, good videos. It's clear that you've dedicated, you guys have devoted a lot of time and effort into to videos. There was a recent Kathy Corison video.
That was a good one.
So I think that you're doing great stuff. And your website was always one of the better ones for finding information about about producers. As someone who is a wine buyer, I feel like that's really helpful to be able to easily access information about the producer. It helped me to sell the wines better. And now your new website is really, it's clear that you've invested a lot in that.
It's a mammoth task to keep a website like that updated. Mm-hmm. It's just,
imagine.
If we have one of the best websites, that's nice to hear, but you know, we're not satisfied with it. You know, it only has maybe 70, 78, 79% of the information that it should have. So it's a bear, because we're so busy selling wine, shipping it out every day, that, you know, we don't have time to input all the data. But from the videos, thank you for mentioning that, because we have put a lot of effort and work into that. And the reason is that we believe that education is a big part of what we do. And we feel a sense of obligation to our producers. You know, they're mostly small farmers, families who have generations upon generations of the same family living on the same land. And they put their trust in us to represent them and to sell their wine properly and to buy the amount of wine that we've promised we're going to buy. And, you know, we believe in them, and that's why we choose them. And they choose us, but we have to do everything we can. The website is one example. The you know, producing the videos in this time, this day and age, video, a 2.5-3 minute video, you know, with the attention span of the average person and the ADD that exists out there, you've got to put it out there. And right, you know, maybe in 3 years or 5 years, it'll be, you know, virtual reality. I don't know what's coming next. But right now, you can get people's attention more easily with a short video that is accurate and true and communicates a little bit of the sense of who this person is, what this place is about. And so, you know, it's a big investment, but you're supposed to have a return on investment, we hope. So that's why I like to look at these things as investments, because I think that, and your recognition of that is part of that return.
Oh, so. Yeah. It helps keep me on the website. And yeah. Ultimately, you know, when selling the wines in a restaurant or a wine bar, it makes you feel more confident selling the wines. So you have better information about them. And I always appreciate it.
You know, we look around, we all have resources and we have assets, and communication is the thing that where the, you know, you can translate those things to other people through communication. We call it public relations. That's really what it is. You can call it anything you want, but it's really communicating that which is special, unique, and important about what it is that we do.
So, all right. Yeah. Well, that's going to wrap us up here.
All right.
And next week, we'll have some more communications about what's special and unique in what we do. But Michael, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Any restaurant that I am ever a wine buyer for, we will always have Skernick Wines and Spirits. You guys are a great partner, and it's been an honor to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
So Joe. Thank you so much. I want to thank David Tadashore, who produced this show. Help was provided by Haley Crane, and Katie Wadley is the executive director of Heritage Radio Network. This has been In the Drink. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Waley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.